It's Monday, January 24th. This is LA Podcast. I'm Scott Frazier, joined today by Cerise Castle and Alyssa Walker. You are listening to episode 210, Global Supply Train. How are you all doing this morning? We're back remote, keeping it safe. Cerise, how's your morning?
My morning is going good. My day has been filled with lots of wind. I went skateboarding yesterday along the Los Angeles River right when the wind was rolling in. And it started out being really fun going downhill, getting pushed by the Santa Anas.
Yeah, you just stand there and it just propels you forward.
Basically, yeah, that was really cool. But then the wind changed directions and I was getting assaulted by palm fronds and dust.
At that point, you're so basically parasailing. Like, you're going to go airborne.
You wear like one of those capes.
I don't know if I'm brave enough for that, but maybe one day.
Alyssa, how are you doing?
Yeah, I also am blown away. And it's not just the fronds and the dust, but those little, it's like the little tiny baby dates or something from the trees that are like, they're like BB gun pellets and they just like spray down and they're on your head, like hitting you like a little buckshot.
It's evolution's like best way to create a new tree is just to shoot seed bullets at you. So some housekeeping before we get started with a very full episode today. We want to thank everybody for listening, especially our Sepulveda Pass holders. We mention it every time. The Sepulveda Pass is our Patreon program, which helps us keep this show going and independent and ad-free, all things that we love, as hopefully so do you, and helps us put out new shows, new content, new information for everyone listening. If you want to join that, it is easily done. Patreon.com/LA Podcast and just $5 a month. Or now we also offer annual subscriptions for $50 a year. You get 2 months free and you get access to cool things like our Discord server where I am at least going to start doing some regular audio chats with our pass holders who are in the Discord feed, and just our way of saying thanks to everybody who's doing that already. Also, we have a newsletter, which we'll link to in the show notes. It's also something you can subscribe to at thelapod.com/newsletter, and it comes every Saturday morning straight to your inbox. This week, we talked about a very fun speech by the mayor, who is, As I always say, he's still the mayor until proven otherwise. He is still the mayor of Los Angeles. All right. So we have a lot to talk about today before we get into it. Alyssa, do you have an LA story that you want to share with the class?
I do, Teacher Scott. Metro went back to resumed fare collection on its buses after 22 months. I know you all talked about it a week that I was out. We've talked about it many times, and I really just wanted to do a story about if Metro was learning anything from this period, because I had a hunch that this was maybe like the biggest free transit experiment in history. I mean, I don't even, it's, when I asked them for the data, they estimated that they gave 281 million bus boardings. That is so many trips that people took for free on our buses. And the ridership compared to other transit agencies didn't drop as much. So we had, at least 50% of our ridership, except for that initial like stay at home order, we were giving like so many people rides. And I wrote a story about it. They were studying some things. They're studying like how much faster the boarding time was. We call it dwell time when you're stopping to pick up passengers. They're looking at other things like, all door boardings that can make sure that you can tap at any place that you go in. But just really, I hope they're listening, because a lot of people shared all these stories when I tweeted out my story, and just these really amazing small ways that free transit just completely changes people's lives, even if they can afford to pay for it, which makes you think about how much it's changing the lives of people who can't actually afford to now switch to paying fares. And so I'll tweet that into our feed so you can see just some of the responses. But I rode the bus this week, and the operator was definitely like very visibly frustrated with all these people trying to tap and like didn't know they had to pay all of a sudden and like fishing out change. I was like, did you like it more when there was no fares? He's like, so much more. So,
damn. Like, did you hear from anyone who was just like, free fares made my, this sounds so stupid, but like free fares made my life worse in some way?
I think there were a lot of comments from people that were like, well, of course, if you make it free, it's just going to be filled with homeless people. And I don't think they were riders or had taken transit during this time. But I mean, there's no downside. And particularly per climate data that Metro provided, it's the biggest intervention they can make when you talk about greenhouse gas emissions of all the programs they run, more than congestion pricing, more than charging like a vehicle mile fee for drivers. And it would cancel out anything that they would build as far as highways. You could use free transit to cancel that.
So, Alyssa, you're telling me that doing something nice for people actually helps the planet?
Believe it or not, Cerise, sometimes it does work out that way, especially when you help people that rely the most on your service. So
what's the plan? Are we funding this? Is this going forward? This sounds like a great investment for the city. It sounds like the city just stumbled upon something great. I'm sure our wonderful mayor is throwing millions at this.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're facing some other challenges. I mean, it's not completely within their control. They're having a lot of problems with operators getting sick and a labor shortage in general. But they should pay the drivers of the buses much more than they're paying them. So I think that would be one place to start, perhaps.
Oh my God! I mean, if we're gonna talk about it before we get to Cerise's LA story, I mean, I just want to say, like, bus drivers at Metro basically start off at minimum wage. Like, the being a bus operator is actually like people have this really weird view of like, law enforcement officers, public service guardians, as Mayor Garcetti calls them, as being like on the front line of a war every day. Actually, the most dangerous job that you can do, the one where you're most likely to be killed at work, is being a bus driver. And we're paying them minimum wage. And of course they're having trouble filling those positions, because what the fuck are we doing? $17.75 an hour for bus drivers. Meanwhile, you know, like if you're actually a police officer, you get essentially like a gold-plated BMW gold-plated,
no,
whatever you want.
You get free transit.
Honestly.
You get to ride the buses for free. They are benefiting from that. they get free transit. But also, like, yeah, we need to think about the operators and, you know, of any employee. This is like the just transition we were talking about, right? So you're talking about like, oh, how could we possibly reduce greenhouse gas emissions and like serve communities that are on the front lines of climate change? How can we possibly do that? This is the answer. This is it right here. And it doesn't cost that much more money. What actually costs money is trying to sign people up for a low income fare program and all those administrative costs and paperwork that goes into that. So this is a win, 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 win. And I just hope Metro sees all this and all this outpouring of support for what they did. And, a lot of the advocates I spoke to had, you know, so many more great comments from people who are not on Twitter. So I hope you can check those out too. I'll link to those in my thread.
I mean, c- conversely, if it's a win-win-win-win and you're not doing it, that's probably a lose-lose-lose-lose, which is where we're at.
Right.
Cerise, LA story.
Oh, man, my LA story. I didn't really think about this. Sorry.
I mean, it could just be your skateboarding story, which we already, that was on me. I just dove right into that.
I don't leave my house anymore, guys. I don't have any
stories.
No,
we will.
I went to the kitchen today.
Cerise is deferring her LA story because she already told it before this. So I will just go into my LA story, which is, it was my partner Sarah's birthday. We went out to a restaurant with her sister who came in town to visit us. And actually, I had been talking to on our last show or 2 weeks ago, I talked about how confused I was by the current state of COVID restrictions and how like restaurants don't really seem to be following all of the precautions that are out. We went to Bestia in the Arts District, which was really fun and delicious. And they actually, I think they were doing like to the letter of the current COVID regulations in the city of Los Angeles. They even had like a little printout that they put on the table for like how to keep servers and other guests safe. We were like eating in the little outdoor courtyard, which was really nice. And it was a good experience. Like they were basically like, okay, everybody has to wear masks. That's an LA city rule, regardless of vaccination status. They were checking vaccination status for people who were eating indoors. And then they were like asking people to remain masked until your full order was placed and while you weren't eating and all this stuff. And it was a very different, I'll just say it was a very different experience than I've had eating out at other places where it seems like it's very lax, to say the least. And that was something that Rachel Reyes was saying, like, when you put the onus on businesses, it's just a total crapshoot what you're going to get out. But we had a really good time and felt safe while doing it. There's still part of me that's like, it's just like a false sense of security, but regardless, you know, we are striving to follow the rules as they change. Okay, so I mean, on that note, I guess we can talk a little bit about the Omicron wave, which has, at least according to recent statistics, probably plateaued. We may be on the other side of the peak in cases, but as everyone listening to this is probably familiar with by now, I hope so by now, cases and hospitalizations and deaths do not peak at the same time. So the number of deaths in LA County has gone up. We now had, on Thursday, we had a day where there were over 100 deaths in Los Angeles County because of COVID. Guys, what is your, like, weekly COVID check-in? What's the state of the state for Cerise and Alyssa on where we're at with COVID right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think things are going to get a lot worse. I have several family members who work in the ICU here in Los Angeles County, and they have been working in the ICU since the early, early days of the pandemic. Talking January of 2020, they saw some of the very first cases. And one thing that is really dark that always seems to come up in our conversations is the number of patients that they all see in the ICU. And all of my relatives agree on this point, which is that once you get to the ICU, it's basically you're going to die, which is really like sad. So every day when I look at the COVID numbers, I do look at the metrics that you've mentioned, Scott. But one thing I also always look at is the ICU. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like my preview of what's to come. And it's really horrific just seeing how right my family has been consistently.
As we've talked about this for now going on 2 years, like one of the things that I've always felt and tried to say, because so much of our conversations as a like as a society, things that you read in the paper and see on the like on TV is like, it's basically like, what is the cheapest way that we can get out of this pandemic? Like, and by cheapest, I mean like in a literal sense, what is the least amount of money that we can spend? And what is the least amount of hit to economic activity that we can take as we get out of the pandemic? And for me, I've always tried to contextualize personally for myself, and then also in comments on this show, that like, there's just not, like nobody is getting out of this cheaply. So many people are dying, and there are going to be so many effects that far outlast the actual pandemic. One of those that I think about, and I don't know if this, I don't know if this matches your experience with your family members who work in the hospital system, Cerise, but one of the things that I read so often is how discouraged and angry and just like beaten down hospital workers are. And especially like as we got into Omicron, into now like our fourth or fifth distinct wave, where we're just like, this one was the one the latest one where hospital workers were like, this really did not need to happen in this way. And I think that like the long-term effects of hospital workers feeling like their work is not valuable, feeling like it is sort of just like futile to come in every day and try and fight against a society that doesn't care whether or not people die. Like that's going to shape things in the long term. And it's like, you can't really put a dollar amount to that, in my opinion.
I think the thing that is affecting them the most right now, sort of on that theme, is the fact that their colleagues are allowed to come to work sick now. And there's a lot of co-infection happening. My grandmother, shout out to her, she was a nurse. She's been a nurse for years. She got her start in the 1970s working on some of the first AIDS patients in the United States, in New York. And she oversaw basically like nurse management at the hospital she was at. And one thing she talked to me a lot about at the start of the pandemic was co-infection and how dangerous it is, and how much work she put into, well, in those days you didn't know how the virus was transmitted, but essentially how much money and investment was put into making sure that the virus did not leave the hospital. And that's something that's just like completely been thrown to the wind now. I think about friends I have that are going in for treatment. I mean, I myself have gone to the doctor. I'm a very sick, sick girl. I go to the doctor a lot. But it's awful to think about. I had one acquaintance of mine talk about their father getting COVID while going in for chemotherapy. So it's like really like the most vulnerable people that have to engage with the hospital system on a regular basis that are going to feel this the most. They're the ones that are going to, you know, pick up a COVID case from a nurse that has come to work on the fifth day of having COVID. Yeah, it's very big eugenics vibes.
Yeah.
And on the complete like opposite, you say that nurses are being told they have to come to work even though they're sick. We have an even greater increase in the number of LAPD officers and sheriff's deputies that are out sick and staying out for an average of, what was the number? It's 20 days for a sworn officer and 30 days for a civilian officer. Yep. So, I mean, what if a teacher, if the teachers in this city did that, if that data came out for teachers, like, can you imagine the type of outrage? We want everyone to get better. We don't want people to come to work sick. But at the same time, what is actually going on here that we have people that we are paying to recuperate at home for up to a month time? It's unclear.
If teachers did that, Josh Barrow from Left, Right, and Center on KCRW has been nonstop posting about teachers' unions and how they're the same as police unions would probably explode. But yeah, no, it is a clear double standard, and it is reflective, of course, of how police are viewed within the. I mean, we're not caught. No one is calling hospital workers public safety guardians, despite the fact that that is probably more applicable than to...
Very accurate description of what they
right,
do.
Right, it's probably much more applicable than to put that label on the police. And yet, here we are, and no one is doing that for teachers either. It's really hard, and I mean, I know it's sort of like a running conversation, but I feel like at a certain point it's like good and therapeutic to like talk through this in a way that it doesn't seem like much of I don't know, like so much of the conversation around COVID right now is around people's changing perceptions of personal risk. And I've also been talking through it that way. And if you're young and you're able-bodied and you have a healthy immune system, your perception of your personal risk has probably changed considerably based on the data that's come out about Omicron. And yet, like, that's a relative... Like, that's all relative to what your personal danger level was with the previous variants. And for a lot of people, it's not changed. And so when we look at the aggregate data, like, a lot of people are still dying. And if you only view that through the lens of the personal risk to you, then you're missing a big part of that picture. So it's, I don't know, it's important to keep that context. And
100.
I really appreciate that, keeping that focus. We want to move on to some news about the fire department, who are also, it's worth noting, having a lot of people call out sick right now. They have a significant proportion of their force who is currently on sick leave because of COVID. But there is some new news. Mayor Garcetti, who we want to talk about more in just a second, the mayor's office had a busy news week, to say the least. But the first item that we're going to get to is Garcetti's proposed appointment of the first woman fire chief of the Los Angeles Fire Department. His nomination for Kristen Crowley to be the first woman chief will go before city council for approval for confirmation. She is a 22-year veteran of the fire department. And this nomination comes at an interesting time for the fire department, which has been racked by accusations of sexual harassment for a long time now, and has struggled to meet even the meager goals that they have set for increasing gender diversity among their ranks. Alyssa, what can you tell us about Kristen Crowley?
Yeah, this was, so remember there was this press conference held by a lot of the women who had come forward at the fire department that was in October, where they enumerated multiple instances of racism, sexism, sexual harassment, abuse, and basically said that the current LAFD chief, Ralph Tarasas, was responsible for this culture that he had created and failed to do anything about after years and years of complaints. They called for his resignation, and 3 months to the day, actually, this announcement was made. And it's not difficult to see exactly how this happened, because these women organized and they came forward and said, this will not do. And Kristen Crowley is one of the people who worked on this 5-year strategic plan that was exactly what these women were asking for, to increase gender and racial diversity within the department. So this was a huge, we're not used to getting good news. I feel like we had two bits of good news this week. We'll talk about the other one later. But this, it was just like a moment where you could actually see like a true change perhaps starting to occur in one of these institutions that had been plagued by not just, I think, the accusations of these women, but also we saw like Proud Boys photos being taken within the department. We saw a lot of Trump supporters, right. A lot of really dangerous anti-vaccine views that have kind of just gone unchecked, really. So this could be a turning point. Crowley herself, this is an amazing story that Garcetti told at the press conference. She's married to another woman who is was in LAFD and had retired. And they were coming up to help people during the Woolsey fire. And the two of them were helping people evacuate and ended up saving 9 homes in Malibu themselves with only garden hoses and shovels, which is just like, I'm sure this endears you to the Malibu wooey dwellers who will support you as fire chief, which is always good. But the story was just, it was just an incredible story and so remarkable, and just showed obviously this great heroism and just the ability to, you know, take action and help people when they needed help. So, and not even in an official capacity, they were just helping, which was pretty remarkable. And I'll give you a quick clip of something that she said when she was introduced at the press conference, which is just reiterating that this is her top priority, was to create a more inclusive department. I'll play that clip for you right now.
We will focus our efforts and enhance our work environment. We will focus on firefighter safety, physical health, and overall emotional well-being. As a fire chief, I vow to create and support and promote a culture that truly values diversity, inclusion, and equity within the entire organization.
So I think this is a remarkable moment. It's going to be very difficult. The department is has very few women in it, and they have not been able to increase those numbers during this entire time that Garcetti's been in office, even though it was his pledge. It's remained pretty much the same. It's crept up a few percentage points. So if she has the support, this could
it could hardly go down, right? Sorry, the number could hardly go down from 2% or whatever it was.
Yeah, we're only looking up from here. But this was good. This was a great move, and it was good to see.
I like. I mean, so like the language that Crowley uses is a clear break from the Terrazas era. I mean, in the fact that just by saying, you know, a vow to create a truly a culture that truly values diversity is an acknowledgement, even if it's not like a head-on acknowledgement, that does not and has not existed, which sounds like, I mean, it sounds like it should be the easiest thing in the world to acknowledge. But for years, there's sort of been a, it's like the problem has been definitely held at arm's length by leadership in the LA Fire Department. And especially when you hear about the accusations of things like putting raw meat in women's lockers, exposing yourself to female colleagues, making rude or sexual comments at work. Like there is a lot of work to be done on this. And I'm kind of curious, Alyssa, like how would you see like change at the, I mean, this is not to like put you super on the spot here, but like if you were just thinking through it, like how would you see change manifesting itself at the fire department in the near term, hopefully?
Well, there are a list of demands. If you go back to that press conference that was held in October, and I think one of the biggest things that they are requesting, which is something that actually came out during the depositions in the Rick Jacobs sexual harassment case, Rebecca Nimberg, who's one of the commissioners, they really just want the problem itself to be properly studied and documented. And that's something that they've been asking for a long time. And the council, you know, wasn't going to take the initiative on that. And they are now, after months and months of these types of interventions. So I think, and what Kristen Crowley herself is bringing to that is the commitment to, you know, really make sure that they're documenting and investigating all the instances that they say that the current chief has ignored. So I think that's a good place to start. And if she's committing to that and does have the support, you know, Nuria Martinez was there at this press conference saying that, she supports her and her agenda. So I think that's a good sign to start. So let's go from there. Find out what's really been going on and have them admit it and then go from there.
Yeah. Culture change is hard, especially at an organization like the fire department, where it's like, you know, like you said, we have a fair amount of people with potentially like extremist views who are working in the fire department. We have a lot of people who don't even live in the state of California who are working in the fire department.
Oh, right. I forgot about that one. Yeah.
culture change is a tough thing. And I really hope that is something that we can see come out of this new regime at the fire department, because it is definitely sorely needed.
And one more just interesting thing about Crowley in particular, she's been very involved with emergency. She was a fire marshal. So that is an interesting urbanist role to play for the fire chief, right? Because she's the one deciding a lot of these questions that we are often talking about, which is, you know, materials used in building and where do you get to build homes? Are they in fire-prone areas? And are we doing a good job with evacuations and making sure that people are able to get out of places that could be trapped. So apparently she's been very involved in these discussions. So this is could be a great ally for people who want to say, use wood, you know, in new ways and not bump up against the same issues that we've had with, the concrete industry trying to force us into an unsustainable building future and force people into sprawl. So when he wasn't nominating LAFD chiefs, our mayor was being a nominee himself, slowly through the Senate is his appointment as ambassador to India. And I believe last week we talked about how the Senate Foreign Relations Committee had advanced his nomination to the full Senate floor. And just an update on that, there were a group of nominees that will be voted on at the end of January that was announced this week. His name was not on that list. So as far as we know, we're going into February on this one. So, which is Black History Month, interestingly enough. Okay.
Huh.
So let's begin this...
Black History Month, you say?
I mean, fitting, because Eric Garcetti, of course,
loves black people. Famously loves blacks.
Black people. I just go back always to the picture of him just like having the laying on of hands during the protest last year.
Oh, during the protest? Yeah.
Yes, yes.
So, Cerise, you wrote a story about... It's hard sometimes to look at some of these headlines because they all say something like Garcetti top aide, and then you're like, and then something not so great, and then it's different top aides each time. So let's hear about this top aide and what your story was about.
So this week I wrote a story for Vice News with some emails that were leaked to me. that were sent back and forth between several top aides, including Ana Guerrero, former chief of staff, Rich Llewellyn, the former chief analyst of the city of Los Angeles, Jeff Gorel, the current deputy mayor of public safety, Andre Herndon, who is now the current chief of staff, was also someone who was CC'd on these emails. And essentially, these emails were Garcetti staffers just talking a whole bunch of smack about Black Lives Matter, calling them annoying, just disparaging a police commissioner that was appointed, saying that she was not being a, quote, loyal soldier because she sent out an email lauding her work with Black Lives Matter. Just putting some context on this, we know that Amy Wakelin, the wife of Mr. Mayor, has called the police 80 times. That's a real Karen number on protesters from Black Lives Matter. I mean, this is something that activists have been talking about for literally years. Garcetti has not met with Black Lives Matter since 2015. And since that time, activists have pretty consistently said that the mayor and his office have a real disdain for them. Well, here's your proof. They talked for the emails that I had access to dated from 2016 to 2017. And that's 2 years of Garcetti staffers just really talking a whole bunch of shit.
And we should also say that the mayor was CC'd on all of these emails. So I couldn't tell how many of them, but you said that you wrote that he was CC'd on some of them.
He was CC'd on some of these emails, yes.
I mean, it's the kind of thing where, like, if the man is nonstick Teflon. It doesn't, like, he was able to say he did not see his dear friend Rick Jacobs making an air crotch grabbing gesture in a picture where he's standing next to Rick Jacobs making an air crotch grabbing gesture. Like, it's so obvious that he will just be like, well, just because I'm CC'd doesn't mean I opened and read this email. And in fact, even if we had proof that he opened it, he would still say he didn't see it. So it's like, it's just impossible to get him to, like, it literally is like nailing Jell-O to the wall. But this story was so incredible.
One thing I also want to mention about those emails is that they were all of these emails were sent on private emails, which, starting from March 2017, is a violation of a California Supreme Court decision that mandates that any city business that is done on private email must CC your city email address. And none of these emails had city email addresses CC, which is really, I mean, like, at a minimum, bad. But I'm sure that this is something that's still going on. You know, and it's something that I am looking into.
It's like one of the many ways in which city government in Los Angeles in particular is, like, flagrantly and continually trying to do these end runs around public disclosure laws, around just, like, anything that would sort of, like, daylight the actual operating practices of the city. Like, this is a really incredible piece of reporting. One of the things that I loved most about your piece, Cerise, was that there's a discussion that has come back time and time again about structural racism and the way in which the government and American society are set up to demonize, hamstring, harm, kill Black people in particular, and anyone who's not white in general. But this one of the conversations in here which is so telling because, you know, Ana Guerrero is somebody who's very close with Mayor Garcetti, who has made a name for himself nationally, if certainly not locally, as somebody who says the right things about structural racism. Ana Guerrero is in one of these emails you have, you note that she says that when people say structural racism, that they're calling her personally a racist. They're calling members of the mayor's office personally a racist. And that's the problem with that.
Right?
Like that is more salient than the actual discourse around structural racism and its impacts on Black people and others.
100%. And it's also been like really interesting to sort of observe the response by people that work with the mayor to this story. Eric Spiegelman, excuse me if I'm butchering that name, the taxi commissioner of Our Fair City, tweeted shortly after the story was published, sort of tired of what I'm reading online, so I'm going to put this here. Ana Guerrero is one of the most dedicated and effective public servants I have ever had the privilege of working with. I consider her a role model. Los Angeles is lucky to have her.
He is
one of the loyal soldiers.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
That's a loyal soldier, Alyssa.
Exactly, right? Like that's what Ana Guerrero was saying, like, if you're a commissioner, your job is to like lay down on the floor and like, I don't know, like throw your body that's into exactly the line it. Of fire.
This came up a lot in my reporting for the story about the Rick Jacobs case. Like if you are not a loyalist, you are cast out. And many people that I talked to said this, like if your loyalty was proven, you get power and leadership positions. And if you introduce any type of questioning of what the agenda is, or if you don't fall in line, you are booted. And what's interesting too about what the response so far, I guess, that we're seeing from this story is, remember when this reporting came out, again, from those same depositions, and this story came out that there was this secret Facebook group where they were disparaging, including Guerrero, were disparaging city officials and Dolores Huerta. Immediately, the mayor took action. Actually, not immediately. It took the second story, I think, for him to take action. But she was put on a leave of absence and did not return to her position, although she was reappointed, I guess, or put back in a strategist role. But it's
with the same salary.
Same salary. But
of $248,000.
But this has not triggered that same response. And I'm just curious about what the difference is. In many ways, this seems worse because it's about more directly related to policy, and also that the mayor himself was CC'd on it on these conversations for, it sounds like, years, and did not take action at that time or intervene at that time.
Well, I would say it's definitely worse because you don't even have what was given as for the LA Times reporting about the Solid Gold Facebook group where Ana Guerrero was making comments about Dolores Huerta and you know, just saying, I hate her, whatever, like making really childish comments. The defense, such as it was, oh, like it was a private thing that they used in their off time and they were blowing off steam or whatever. And you can't say that about this. This is clearly in
about... Well, that
about-
is kind of what they said. That was kind of what the statement was, Cerise, right? That you got from the mayor's office.
What they said about the comments were, if there are comments that shouldn't have been made by current staff, we will address those internally and we will continue pushing forward. My question to that is, why are you taking action now? Why is this an issue now? You've had these emails since 2016. It's only an issue when reporters come knocking. That's troubling.
That's problematic. And also, like, as we see so often, and actually, I think it's interesting because the mayor's office seems to be sort of like in a class of its own in this regard, but like their unwillingness to even acknowledge that there is a problem. Like the statement, the quote that you just read, Cerise, is like hypothetical. Like if there is something that shouldn't have happened, then this is what we would do. But like there's no indication that they, like they're not even responding to the reporting. They're not saying this is something that shouldn't have
happened.
They're
not even acknowledging that something bad has occurred, right?
Yeah, right. Like, and the mayor's office does, like the way that they like sort of just close ranks like that. And I think I can already imagine that people responding to this segment would be kind of like, oh, well, like, what do you expect? Of course the mayor is going to, he's a politician. Of course he's going to appoint people who are loyal to him. I mean, there's a difference between appointing people and hiring people who are your political allies and only accepting or trying to push forward people that you would consider to be loyal soldiers whose main quality is that they, like, owe you some sort of personal fealty. That's, like, that's something that obviously there are few comparisons made between the two of them, but that's something that Donald Trump did and everybody agreed was bad, you know? But like Mayor Garcetti has this, in my opinion, unearned reputation and as somebody who's a technocrat, right? And somebody who's like, his leadership comes from data and he puts the people in charge that are right for the position. But if actually what's going on behind the scenes is Garcetti world demands that only people who are going to be in every conceivable situation put their loyalty to Eric Garcetti first and not actually respond to emergent policy needs or respond to feedback that they're receiving from the public, then that's a problem. And it's indicative of, I think, a wider set of problems than this story is even able to uncover. But I'm sure, like, you know, I'm sure it doesn't stop here, basically.
And then he, at the end, the timing was just kind of funny. I wouldn't say funny, but the story. The day that the story came out, he had just given this speech where it seemed like at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, where it seemed like he was speaking very directly to like protesters that were outside his house instead of the mayors of all the major cities of the U.S. Scott, you wrote this amazing piece for the newsletter with a criticism of that speech.
Well, I mean, I've... As somebody who over the years, Mayor Garcetti has been in office in the mayor's office now for nearly a decade, 9 years, and he's of course on his way out. But throughout that time, I have had the good or bad fortune to listen to a lot of his speeches, and this one in particular. I mean, it just the way that it is reported on every time that the mayor gives a speech like this to a big audience. It's like Mayor Garcetti goes and he says, there's cause for hope, America, or it's time for us to hope or whatever. And then it's like, if you actually listen to the speeches frequently, that in order to arrive at that summary, you have to eliminate a lot of rhetorical fuckery. In this case, I felt like I really wanted to go through it in a more substantial way just because he seemed to be positioning it as sort of like his valedictorian speech. He obviously thinks of himself as the valedictorian of mayor school. And now like he's talking about how he is soon to be leaving to the Republic of India, where he's going to be almost certainly going to be the ambassador very soon, if not at a known date. So he gave a speech to the U.S. Conference of Mayors touting all of the things that he did there during his time, including starting the Latino caucus there and chairing it for a while. And starting various other extracurricular clubs at Mayer School. And this speech was, as you mentioned, Alyssa, like entirely about how mayors do things that not only other politicians don't do, but also that other Americans don't do. And he used for his for the basis, I think, for this argument, his time in Los Angeles and what he sort of decried as the anger that he faced from voters in Los Angeles and from protesters over decisions that he made. He categorized that as basically a sign of the strength of his leadership and sort of the unreasonableness, if I could say that, of the demands of protesters. Just to like give you, I mean, the speeches filled with some of the most horrible turns of phrase, some of which utterly nonsensical, many of them just...
My girlfriend called it slam poetry.
I did too.
Which I can't unhear.
Someone said it was Dr. Seussian, which I also felt like was relevant.
Yes.
I mean, we'll just play one clip. I mean, it didn't make a lot of sense to make this be the focus of your speech on the day after like voting rights legislation is getting voted down, to say that we should be more moderate and try to get along with people that we don't know as well or don't like. Absolutely the wrong message to be giving in DC on that day. But this is a nonpartisan group, this US Conference of Mayors. So like, I guess he still wants to be the one who is compromising even amongst the mayors. But we'll play just one, the most famous one, the open mic session sounding part at the end of the speech.
And I had our producer, Brian, add something a little extra special just for you.
And I know that Americans want government to work, not to argue. And we can show them that it's possible. And I know that democracy doesn't just manifest itself in the big leagues ballot box on election days, but in the little leagues batter box on game days, not just on loud arguments on cable television preaching to the choir, but those quiet conversations in the stand with another parent who has a different perspective but loves their child as much as you do yours. I know that change happens when we once again focus more on our dreams than on our memes, when we get busy fixing the streets instead of polishing our tweets. That's what democracy demands. That, my friends, is what democracy is. Hash it out, don't hashtag it out. We aren't some sort of passive bystanders in this democracy. We are its owners and its caretakers. And leadership means making the least popular decisions today that are the best way forward tomorrow. Leadership means that by the time it seems right, it's often too late, but when it seems too early, that's the right time to take a bold step forward.
Hashtag it out. Don't hash it out.
Hash it out. Don't hashtag it
out. So, like, I mean, is...
Sister Soldier,
is Darcy. Is he... is this your audience? Is this what you're going to use this time to say to mayors? Mayors aren't doing this. Like, what are you talking about?
It's hard to, like... It's hard to miss that. The audience doesn't really seem to be paying that much attention either. This is a conference where the people are eating breakfast. They are, you know, it's like whatever. They're waking up. They're drinking their fucking really shitty Hilton coffee. They are definitely looking forward to hearing from President Joe Biden and are not necessarily that interested in hearing from Mayor Eric Garcetti. But it's obvious in the way that like he hits some of these applause breaks really hard, and then you wait a couple seconds and you get the kind of like polite clapping. As immediately as comes to mind, as you would expect at a slam poetry open mic night at a coffee house.
Maybe they were snapping.
Maybe
They were giving him.
Maybe they were snapping. I mean, but yeah, it's really difficult to, for me at least, to take anything away from this particular speech other than like, this is a pure encapsulation of what Los Angeles does not need in its mayor and what we will not miss once he is out the door. It is, I mean, my favorite personally of the quotes that I included in the newsletter. If we believe that our media is misleading us, all we will get is misleading media. It doesn't mean anything. It's not correct. I just like that one really stuck with me because it seems obviously not to be true. Like it's almost like he's making a case against media literacy. Like you shouldn't, should not.
Well, he also said, if you have nothing but contempt for your government, all you'll have is contemptible government. So does that mean both of those things, if you question the institution, they're gonna come after you or something? Like, what does that mean?
That is a Daniel Patrick Moynihan quote, which he, with an extremely broad smile on his face, like major cat that ate the canary vibes. He was like, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who's footsteps I hope to follow as ambassador to India. Like he picked Daniel Patrick Moynihan, former Secretary of State to Lyndon B. Johnson and then to Nixon, specifically so that he could just be like, look at me, I'm in the big leagues of world diplomacy. But yeah, I mean,
what does it mean? What does that quote mean?
What does it mean?
He did his homework for mayor school.
Especially as an ambassador. When he did go to ambassador school, that's true. He went from the mayor school to ambassador school.
He got an A.
He did get an A.
I just don't know what these things mean. I don't know what the media stuff was very weird because it was like questioning. It's like people don't trust the media and this is why. And then why? Because too many people are tweeting. I don't know. Like it was very confusing.
Too many people are talking and it's bad. We need that to stop.
Yeah. I mean, he does seem to have a he does seem to have a point of view that democracy should be a monologue and not a dialogue, right? Like you elected me and now I'm going to talk to you.
It's pretty anti-democracy, no?
Well, I mean, just think like Alyssa and Matt actually found that really good. They took that really great picture and decrypted it of him texting a staffer saying that he didn't want to be giving speeches anywhere that protests could happen. So like instead, you know, he's not doing his farewell tour in Los Angeles. He's doing it 2,000 feet away from the Oval Office where he obviously feels much more comfortable because Angelenos are not there.
So another thing that is attracting a lot of chatter this week in our fair city is what's happening down at the Union Pacific rail tracks. Yes, this is a story in 2022, not 1942. So there was a train that derailed, which is number one, really dangerous. I hope everyone is okay. But when that train derailed, it sat there for a little bit. And thanks to reporting from LA Taco, we know that Union Pacific has a whopping 8 agents patrolling the tracks from here to the border, which seems like not a lot. That train sat pretty much unguarded for a little bit. And when things are sitting full of fabulous goods that people have probably been waiting for. And there were videos that were circulating all over social media, on local news, of these train tracks just littered with thousands of boxes. And there's been a lot of chatter that, there's something real awful going on here. It's so much rampant crime. What's really going on, Alyssa?
Yeah, like this all started to go down like a week ago, and there are all these photos being shared. And of course, that is the narrative, which is like, this crime wave has now reached the tracks, and look at all your stuff, people. Get mad because your things have been pilfered, and the containers have been pilfered, and you won't get that bag that you ordered from Louis Vuitton. They always mention Louis Vuitton every time.
Always Louis Vuitton.
What was really interesting, it's always Louis Vuitton. Protect.
Why are y'all ordering your Louis? Go to the store.
Because it's smash and grabs.
It's an experience. Enjoy it.
We can't, Cerise. big shout out. You know, there was this like hyperventilating from everybody that, you know, crime narrative. And Mike 80, bless him, in LA Taco, like had this amazing story that showed actually, we talked to employees and they're saying that they don't have enough people to actually watch the tracks. So what's actually going on here, and whose fault is it that this giant government subsidized corporation is not able to control losses on a jurisdiction that it controls? Like, there is no police force technically in the city or county of LA that is allowed to do the job they do because it's their tracks. So it's all this blaming, and of course, like, Gascon gets brought into it again, and we'll talk about that in a second. But I also was just so, of course, like, if anybody complains about something being stolen and it has to do with Louis Vuitton, Gavin Newsom will fly to your city the next day, and he will get a broom, and he will sweep up that mess. And we saw him out on the tracks with his, like, he's, like, lifting, like, cardboard and putting him in this, like, front loader, and it's just like, okay. And then, of course,
was he wearing work?
Always, yeah. He's got really nice, and he's got his little mask with a bear on it. But like, he announced a task force. All you have to do is like bring a Louis Vuitton bag into the situation, and he will show up. And then also made some incredibly troubling comments, blaming it on gangs first of all, and then he kind of walked that back. And then he said it looked like a third world country. He did not. I apologize for that. And then all the other stories have also been blaming it on saying it's an organized crime ring that recruits homeless people who live near the tracks, which was also later proven to be not necessarily true.
I mean, it doesn't matter. It gets immediately published on like CBS and Fox and all of these other
international news
outlets
too. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And the legacy media runs with it, of course.
Let me just say, I want to caveat my comments by saying, if I'm accusing CBS and Fox of being misleading media, then all I am ever going to get is media that misleads me, or whatever Garcetti said. So this is my fault. I'm sorry personally to the people of Los Angeles, because it's my fault that CBS LA published something saying that train robberies were up 356% because of DA George Gascon. Like, that's clearly on us as readers, and not and the responsibility does not lie with them. But yeah, this whole thing has been absolutely insane. Union Pacific wrote a letter to the DA blaming him, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, specifically blaming him, which I don't even think...
You can put whatever you want in a letter.
Yeah, they wrote this letter blaming him, and then Gascon wrote this amazing letter back, which this letter has not gotten as much pickup because it's filled with truths. But here's a great quote from that letter, where you do have this nice pointing of fingers from one law enforcement agency to the other. So that has been one positive of this. According to LAPD Chief Al Labrada, UP does little to secure or lock trains and has significantly decreased law enforcement staffing. It is very telling that other major railroad operations in the area are not facing the same level of theft at their facilities as UP. We can ensure that appropriate cases are filed and prosecuted. However, my office is not tasked with keeping your sites secure, and the district attorney alone cannot solve the major issues facing your organization. Thank you, George.
I want everybody to go back and watch the first Fast and the Furious movie, because it's one of the most profitable franchises of all time. Y'all love that shit. And then in real life, when people get caught acting really dumb in LA and their trains get held up, it's, you know, everybody wants to talk about. It's the end of the world and it's a third world country and all of this. I mean, this story is just blowing my mind on a daily basis. I love that everything gets tied back to Prop 47 and George Gascon as though like any of those things make any sense in this context. I love that our governor apparently has like the red phone hotline, like the nuclear hotline for like whenever a Louis bag goes missing anywhere, like some, or like, I mean, it's just like any fucking luxury goods that do not make it to their destination. He is there. He will be there. He doesn't care what time of day. And it's like the
As long as there's cameras there, he'll be there, Scott. Yeah. So Gascon, as you remember, was one of our many local elected officials who was facing a recall, an attempt at a recall. He was not recalled. That campaign did not advance. And this week, we got news that yet another recall campaign did not advance. This was the other bit of good news that I was teasing earlier in the episode. The city clerk's office announced that the recall Mike Bonin, councilmember for CD11, which is the West Side, was short 1,352 signatures. And in fact, of the signatures gathered, the total number of about a third of them were not valid. Scott, can we run the numbers here?
Oh, sure. I mean, Holly Walcott, the city clerk, actually did it for us already. But yeah, I mean, what you said is the top line takeaway. Get all of the Bonin recall supporters in a room. Look to your left, look to your right. One of the three of you should not fucking be here because you are not an eligible voter in the city of Los Angeles. this was fairly unexpected for me. I kind of went on, I had like a little arc with the Bonin recall where at first with the progress that they were apparently making, I was like, okay, this is a real threat to pass. And then later on, I started being like, okay, well, I think when it goes to the ballot, I think that Bonin is going to be able to stay in office. But not in my wildest imaginings did I expect that the campaign to recall Bonin had done such a poor job of quality control that they would have 13,000 signatures thrown out and end up short of what they needed to make the ballot. So that 1,352, I mean, just... To go through, I won't do all of the exact numbers, but just to go through what needs to happen in order for a signature to be valid. There are specific ways that the signatures are taken down. Like you need to have a specific format with the petition in a way that's not misleading so people know what they're signing. You need to have the person who is collecting signatures needs to be clearly identified on like each page and all of that stuff. That's all administrative. But then when you get to actually signing the document, you need to be a resident of CD11. You need to be a registered voter on or before the day that you sign the petition. You need to be basically like, you need to be eligible to vote in the recall contest. So what they did, and you can only do it once. So they had a lot of duplicates. They had a lot of people who were not eligible to vote because they either did not live in the city of Los Angeles at all, or they were not registered to vote in the city of Los Angeles, or they were not registered to vote at an address in CD11. And yeah, so this is just like a crash and burn, complete like face plant at the not even at the goal line, but like at the like 25 yard line for the recall effort. And here we are, like, you know, we've gone through this with now so many candidates and not a single one of them locally has even made it to the ballot. When does it end is my question for you all. Like, when does it end?
Never, Scott. It never ends.
Like, I feel like for the Bonin recall, for a lot of these rich West Side people, you know, I can hear it already on social media. like one random person from the Bonin recall with like 15 numbers in their Twitter handle is going to be like, we're not all rich. How dare you? But yeah, like the people on the West Side, I think, are just going to kind of like sort themselves out of LA in the familiar phenomenon known as white flight. Like, this is kind of, it seems like it's sort of playing itself out all over again, where it's just sort of like those people who have the means, a lot of them are going to just sort of like that. To me, that's the only way the recalls ever end, is if like those people just are like so fed up that they just go somewhere else. Otherwise, we just keep going through the same charade over and over again.
Well, and a lot of them did say that. I think they were in their tantrums that they're leaving, they're going to move away, and but they're mad that their house values haven't grown as much as they expected them to during this time. But I also want to note that, yes, I mean, will we ever know how much money was spent on this? How much money was raised by this? I mean, these people have spent now, these people have tried to do this multiple times, and I'm safe to say they've raised millions of dollars maybe over all these different efforts. And they say that their major concern is homelessness. They don't like seeing people that don't have places to live in their district. And if these people had spent their district, their city, if they had spent some of this energy and money actually helping those people instead of trying to recall the one council member, one or two council members that is actually trying to do something about that in the city, their lives would be a little bit better in the place that they live. Instead, they're paying people $6 per signature, reportedly, to go out and get these fake signatures. And that money is just
being lit
on fire.
Yeah, it's...
Quit that logical thinking.
You're right. This is not the first time Bonin has faced a potential recall. And actually, to your point, the last one was an effort spearheaded in large part by people from Manhattan Beach who were mad about street safety improvements that Bonin was trying to do.
Oh, that's
in
right. Sometimes
the city
it's
of Los
road
Angeles.
Diets. Right.
So, like, it does go, it's like you don't get to recall not your council member. You don't get to recall someone else's elected official if you're trying to make things safer for people who live in that district. It's absolutely crazy. And all I can say is, you know, I personally got to say shout out to Mike Bonin for, despite this being the most credible recall challenge and the one that looked like it was really a threat to make it to the ballot and
it
to
succeed.
It was
a little close for, like, yeah.
Close for comfort, certainly. I got to say shout out to Mike Bonin for continuing. I mean, he throughout his time in office, Councilmember Bonin, in my opinion, has continued to move to the left, which is great. And when he was facing this this really credible recall threat, did not back away from that. He continued to act as though, you know, he was just doing his job, which is exactly what he was doing. So that's, we need more of that. We need more of that throughout the city, and hopefully we can get more of that.
Just one tiny other additional recall notice. There was another Culver City recall attempt to recall Daniel Lee and Alex Fish, who are mayor, vice mayor of Culver City. Right now, Daniel Lee is the first Black mayor in Culver City history. No coincidence, I'm sure, with that recall effort. So that also failed. So everyone, just stop recalling and start
using the money on actually solving these issues that you have an issue with. Like, you don't want to see homeless people, take those $6 and, I don't know, get them a hotel.
Yeah, but
room.
That would be like bribery, Cerise. We can't have that.
Oh, right. Right. Helping people is bribery. Excuse me.
Right.
Sorry.
I guess if you're using it to get a hotel room, that doesn't count as bribery, but just be careful or else Kevin DeLeon will come after you.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been episode 210 of LA Podcast. We're going to be back with a new episode next week. And also next week, we are reconvening our movie club, 30 Mile Zone, and we are going to have it on its own feed, which is very exciting. So please look out for the spring calendar so you can watch along with us. We'll be back soon. Bye.
Is it paradise?